the Sermon on the Mount. Back to the beginning on the passage here in chapter 5, we see that Jesus saw the crowds that were following. He looked out at them. He saw. He was concerned about them. There was a multitude following him. He had a handful of disciples that are his disciples, that are his chosen people that he's going to invest his life in for the next 3.5 years. And so it's concerned that they start right. He takes the disciples up on the mountainside. He sits down and he begins to teach them. As Jesus is sitting and the disciples are sitting here below him, below them are a multitude, it says, of people. Jesus has got a very short time with them. This is the very beginning of the ministry. He wants to impart some fundamentals of what it means to be a disciple of Jesus Christ. He wants to be able to get the word to the multitudes as well as to the disciples, and this works really well. He begins with the basics of them. He starts with the very foundational principles of what it means to be a Christian. We call those the Beatitudes. The Beatitudes really are the foundational principles of being Christian. By the time you walk through the Beatitudes, you know what a Christian is, because a Christian is what the Beatitudes lay out. And then he starts out with this. He's talking to the disciples. Remember, he's sitting here, handful of people right here. He's looking at them saying, "You are the salt of the earth. But if the salt has lost its taste, how shall its saltiness be restored? It is no longer good for anything except to be thrown out and trampled under people's feet." We move from foundational principles to what a Christian is to what a Christian does. He moves from foundational to practical. When Jesus says you are the salt of the earth, you're the light of the world, he's defining what a Christian is. While it's true that a believer is supposed to be poor in spirit, he's supposed to be mournful over sin, he's supposed to be meek, he's supposed to be thirsty and hungry for righteousness, he's supposed to be disposed toward peacemaking and willing to suffer, this is not intended to be understood in an isolated relationship from the world that he lives in. He's supposed to manifest those characteristics to the world. Beyond that, he's to practice them in a way that's going to affect the world positively. Like salt affects a medium that it's placed in. The thought seems to be that when the Beatitudes are foundational in your life, the following in the sermon, what we call the Sermon on the Mount, that's going to be the normal or logical or reasonable or rational outcome. You will be what this is if you are what that Beatitude said. In reference to this verse, James Montgomery Boyce asked the questions, and I think it's a good question. Do you make men thirsty? Do you make women thirsty? Jesus has been outlining principles that make a life distinctive from the world's point of view. Now he moves to the practical explanation of what a Christian life really is. We'd call the rest of the sermon the application. At the end of the 19th century, there was a feeling of confident optimism in the Western world. It was based on a belief that the ongoing biological and philosophical evolution of thought was eventually going to solve all of the world's problems. Dr. D. Martin Lloyd-Jones wrote this. He said, "It is indeed pathetic to read the idea of the thinkers, so-called. He says, the philosophers and the poets and the leaders toward the end of the last century, wars were going to be abolished, diseases were going to be cured, suffering was going to be made more tolerable, but it was also going to finally be eradicated. It was going to be an amazing century. Most of the problems that they knew about were finally going to be gone because man had finally begun to think. The masses, through education, would cease giving themselves to drink and immorality and vice. And as all the nations were going to be educated and to think, and they were going to hold conference instead of rushing to war, the whole world was soon going to be a paradise. He wrote and said this was not a caricature of the situation. It was confidently believed. The 20th century was going to change history. Here we are, 18 years into the 21st century, and we still haven't resolved diseases, and we still have wars, and there are conflicts going everywhere. Families are falling apart. Have you seen any diminishing of alcoholism or drug addiction? Or all those things are still with us. According to Jesus, the Christian, that's you and me, is to clearly influence the society that he lives in, and this must be true wherever the principles of the gospel rub up against the religious, political, economic, or social issues of a Christian's community. The emphasis of the verse. The emphasis is on the first verse, first word again. Ye, or you. You. It's the emphatic in the Greek, where therefore it means you and you alone, speaking to the disciples now. Remember, don't let this escape from you, that Jesus is speaking to a handful of people here who are his disciples. He looks at them and he says, you and you alone are the salt of the earth. He doesn't say, if you are the salt. He says, you are the salt. I think the question is are you who are salt functioning as salt? Disciples. One of the aspects of discipleship is that we are salt. Do we function as salt in the world we live in? Now, I'll say a little bit about that as we go along. When you read those words, it's not just a description of a Christian, it's also a description by implication of the world in which you find yourself. What does it imply if he says, you are the salt of the earth? What does it imply about the world that we live in? Well, if you put salt, you ever cut your hand? I was raised on a dairy farm. My dad was, he always had this thing of this bag of salt sitting in the back of the manger, and he'd throw feed on, and then it was our job to go get a cup, and we'd take a cup of salt and we'd throw it on top of the feed. But if you'd been wrestling with calves and ended up with a few busted knuckles, when you stuck your hand in that bag of salt, there was enough salt on the side of the bag that even though you were very careful, you'd rub a little bit of that salt into your busted knuckle. And I'm here to tell you, that was unpleasant. Now think about this. He says to these disciples, you are the salt of the world. We should irritate some of those busted knuckles out there in the world. But I think more importantly, salt was used, and we don't understand this so much because all of us have freezers, or most of us have freezers, or at least an ice box on the top of the refrigerator. So we don't really understand really the idea that they understood. When the disciples were talking, when Jesus was speaking to the disciples, and he says, you are the salt of the earth. You're the salt of the world. You're the salt that's going to retard putrefaction. So that when he says you are the salt, what he's saying is it's critical that you act as salt in the world that you live in. The world is a rotten place. The Bible has always said that about the world. It's fallen, it's sinful, it's bad. The tendency is always to evil and to war and to unkindness and to wickedness. It's like meat that has a tendency to rot. It doesn't take long. You take a nice, big, thick steak and you throw it out in the sun. It won't take very long before that steak is tender. But it doesn't matter how tender it is. You don't want to eat it because it smells awful. But you can take that same steak and you can rub some salt really hard into that, and it'll last for a long time. The disciples, the world they grew up in, salt was the only preservative there was. It's the way they preserved everything. The Bible is full of endless illustrations like this. You see it manifesting itself in the very first book. He said, although God had made everything good or perfect, sin entered into the world in the first couple of chapters there, and you find evil, corrupting element begins immediately in the world. As you read through the sixth chapter of Genesis, you see God saying, my spirit's not always going to strive with man. The pollution became so bad. The rot became so bad that the only solution was the flood. You are the salt of the earth. The flood comes, all that evil and that corruption and that pollution is washed away. Only one family in which the Spirit of God lives survives. But it isn't too long before you come up with the historical events of Sodom and Gomorrah, with all of their almost unimaginable sinfulness and corruption. And that's the way the story goes all through the Scripture, over and over again, all through the pages of sacred history. You find this the Bible continually puts before us the persistent tendency toward decay. The world is bad. The world we live in is bad. It's sinful. It's evil. And any optimism with regard to it outside of the retentive, restorative work of salt is an illusion. Doesn't happen. What does it mean to be salt? I wrote this because I want to make sure that you get this idea. Salt is essentially different from the medium in which it is placed. But in a sense, it exercises all of its qualities by being different. Now, let's put that into the framework of our culture. Let's go back to this. Here's how our Lord puts it. If the salt loses its saltiness, how can it be made salty again? It's no longer good for anything. See, the salt has to display its character or its quality in exactly it being different. The very characteristic of saltiness proclaims a difference. For a small amount of salt in a large medium is at once apparent. until you're really clear of that, we don't really begin to understand the Christian life. I stated last week, when we were talking about the willingness to be persecuted because of righteousness' sake, that the Christian man or woman is essentially different from everybody else. When you become a Christian, what happens is that the Spirit of God begins to dwell in you. And when the Spirit of God dwells in you, you are absolutely different from everyone who does not have the Spirit of God living in them. That's part of what makes us salty. The Christian is not only to be different, he is to glory in that difference. That's a little tough for us, isn't it? We are a culture of people who want to fit in. And the more, and it doesn't take any time to see it, when the fads change, you see, it isn't long until everybody starts conforming to that fad. Back in the 60s, when those shirts were popular, Mike's, we would all wear. Sorry, Mike. I just couldn't resist that. I thought we had to lighten the climate a little here. We're to glory in our difference. We should be proud of the fact that we're Christians. When you go to the restaurant, you should be proud of the fact that you could bow your head and pray and ask a holy God to bless your food. Salty. Salty. We are to be as different from the normal people as Christ was different from the world to which he came. Ouch. There are those who say the function of salt is to give health. That's primarily life-giving, and I think the purpose of salt is, I think it's primarily to prevent putrefaction. It's primarily, the design is to preserve. It's not to act as an antiseptic, but that's really what it is. The function of salt was preservative. In Christ's day and for many centuries afterwards, salt was the only manner of preservation that there was. I said that earlier. The only way to preserve it was to rub salt into the meat, and that would resist spoilage. Jesus said that those who followed him were the salt of the earth. He was teaching that the world, apart from God, is in a state of decay because of sin. But through his power, his disciples were able and actually obligated to slow down that putrefaction. I wonder how often we see ourselves as agents in the world slowing down the rot. If you read the book of Revelation, it reveals for us clearly we don't win that war. The war is taken care of by Christ. Because the world is so rotten that the believers are taken out. So the world can be judged by its own rottenness. Two opposing errors have always gone along with attempts of the church to meet its social responsibility. And when you understand clearly that we are salt in a rotten world, and we're supposed to slow down the rot. When you grasp that, you don't make these two mistakes. The first mistake is this. The first error is a thought that the world is basically good and is gradually going to get better and may even become perfect through the Christian social action. That we can just do enough good things that the world will finally get better. I have a friend of mine who had a Christian school. He was a pastor in the same town that I was, and he was a strong proponent of this idea. He believed that if we just all be doing the best we can do, the world will just get better, and somehow, some way along the way, we're going to find paradise. And then his wife left him for another man. And his theology and his experience collided. The opposition to this point of view, Jesus points out very clearly that the world is basically in a state of decay and it's only capable of becoming worse. The only thing that will slow down that worsening are Christians being Christians. Are Christians living the Beatitudes? We need to remember that the world is dead spiritually. It means that life has gone out of the body, and the microbes of sin will eventually, if left to themselves, reduce the world to a stinking, disgusting, unapproachable carcass. That is truth. The second error is the view that if this is so, because the world is so rotten, then the Christian should try to disassociate himself from the world as much as possible. Now, when we don't understand that our job is to retard spoilage, then it's real easy to grab a hold of that. Because I don't want to stink. I worked for a time as a mortician's assistant. You do what you got to do. We had a fellow that was cremated in a meth lab. His body was so disgusting. I can't even describe it to you. But for 2 days after we handled that body, I could feel it, I could smell it, I could taste it. That putrefaction was so bad. I couldn't get away from it. I wanted to disassociate myself as much as possible from him. I took two showers the first day I went home. I couldn't get rid of that smell. I think maybe it was more in my brain than it was on my body, but I could not get rid of it. As a Christian, when we live in the world and we see the horrible things happening, the immorality happening, the abuse, the disgusting things that happen around us, we want to run away. But if we remember that we're salt, we can't. Our job is to retard the spoilage. Salt as a restorative agent. Salt as a retarder to putrefaction does no good sitting on the shelf. You can have that wonderful steak sitting right there on the picnic table and the salt sitting next to it, and it will not help it. That salt has to come out of the salt shaker. It has to get put down on the meat, and then it has to be ground in. Doesn't that sound pleasant? See, remember now, we're salt. What does that say? The only way we can retard spoilage in the world is if we allow God to grind us into the world. It is not a pretty picture. It is an essential picture. I don't know where I am. Give me a minute and I'll find out where I'm at. That means we have to be Christians at work. That means we have to be Christians at home. That means we have to be Christians when we go to the movies. That means we have to be Christians when we go to the restaurant. That means we have to be Christians when we run into people who are not nice to us. We need to be Christian wherever we are. When you're up on the roof and you're driving nails in and you're hammering in shingles and you miss and you hit your thumb, you need to be a Christian. Because somebody out there needs your retarding agent in his or her life. It makes us see the world different. We see everything differently when we see this. You are the only hope. Jesus, speaking to the disciples, he says, you are the hope of the world. And if the salt loses its saltiness, we don't have any hope. Someone said it. If you put salt on stuff, it dissolves. I'm going to have to dissolve and be not. Yeah, that's right. You be nothing. You're the agent of preservation. There's a sense in which salt has to be dissolved if the work ever gets done. It has to almost. We have to be dissolved from our own interests. We have to extend our lives into the worlds that we don't see very many Christians. I'm so proud of the elders in this church. I have to talk about. Carl did something this last week, Saturday, that I think is so important. And it wasn't just Carl; he took some other guys with him. But Carl somehow saw a need. And he brought it up to our men's group. And he said, you know, this gal's down here and she's incapable of moving herself. I'd like to take a few guys down and help her move. They were down there half the day. Well, he took his wife too to keep him online, but they went down there and I like Carl's statement. It was quite an eclectic group of people that you said, or something, words to that effect, of people. They were down there being salt. When they asked why was he there, they could tell him because Jesus Christ. Because they're part of a church. They love the Lord and they want to help people out. That's being salt in the world we live in. I'll bet you $10 that Carl and Julie would have liked to have stayed at home, put their feet up on the deck, and enjoyed the day. But instead of consuming themselves, they allowed themselves to be used up. Keith went along too. It was a fun trip, wasn't it, Keith? See, when we do what we're supposed to do, yeah, we expend part of ourselves, but we get so much more back from that. That's being salt. When we fulfill our mission, you know, it's an interesting thing. I was in the military. How many of you guys were in the military? And girls, yes. One of the things, I don't know about you, but I was in June. I went in June of 64, and they love to have you run. They love to watch you sweat. But every morning, we stood in line, and they came by and gave us those little white pills. What were they called? salt pills. They wanted you to take in fluid so you'd pass that salt back out again. That was, you're supposed to keep doing that. Because if the body doesn't put that all out, the body doesn't function. And if the church fails to put salt out, it becomes unfunctional in the Master's message. The more I'm here at this church, the more I am thrilled by it. I saw a little handicapped child on Sunday at on Wednesday at an Awana program that was included. I see somebody with a handful of kids, no, with a bucket full of kids standing up saying, "I'm going to do Vacation Bible School." Salt. Salt, folks. That's what it's about, being salt. Another function of salt is to provide flavor. Salt makes taste. You become a diabetic. My poor wife has just discovered she's a diabetic. The first thing they start doing is taking away her salt. Everything tastes like cardboard. See, I like to take salt, pour it in my hand, and eat it. God help me if I ever become a diabetic. What's going to happen to me? I don't know how I'll survive. But at any rate, my point is that it makes things tasteful. Without Christianity, without Christ, the world is tasteless. Why do we have so many teen suicides? Why do we have so much drug use? Why do we have so much adultery? Why do we have so much, you name it? It's because we don't have Christ. Their words are, everything is boring. Talk to a teenager. They're all bored. Unless they're working. But with Christ, when we understand that we are the salt of the world, we go out into the world and we make the world tasteful. That's our job. And it don't take a lot of salt to make it tasty either, does it? Just a little bit of salt. All of a sudden, everything tastes better. All right, so how do we apply our saltiness to the world? I've alluded to it some already, partly because I like emphasizing how we are doing the salty things we're supposed to do. There are those who think the church makes it salty by making great pronouncements. Was the message that bad? I understand. You know, it's great being in a church where I can just be me. You know, everybody probably doesn't think that, but there are ideas in the church that in the world that the church should make pronouncements, but pronouncements don't retard rot. Salt retards rot. Jesus looked at those disciples and he didn't say, "I want you to go out and tell everybody they shouldn't rot." What he said was, "I'm going to send you out into the world and they're going to beat you up and they're going to kill you, but you're going to retard the rot." As Christianity becomes less and less and less apparent, we're going to see more and more and more evidences of rot. So it's important that we figure out what we're supposed to do. The way we do that is we live the life that we're called to. If we can just fulfill the Beatitudes, well, we'll fail at it. But that's why we have Jesus. Remember I made that point? He doesn't lower the standards. He just gives us Christ so that he can meet the standards in us. So we don't ever want to miss that. We're not saying that somehow we can just pull our own bootstraps up and be what we're supposed to be. We're leaning on Jesus. It's done by the way we live our life, by the character and the quality that makes us who we are. By being the man or woman in every sphere of life that we meet, a Christian. When a Christian lives as a Christian, and he's in a group of people, and he walks into a room, it changes the climate of the room. A few weeks ago, I was with my boss and the guy that I work with, and we were down at a place where we were dealing with car parts and car stuff, and we got to just talking, and the guy was... who he was, and he was using profanity regularly. And then he asked me, well, what do you do? And I said, well, I'm a pastor, but I'm retired. And his face got red, and he said, oh, pastor, I'm sorry. And I said, you know, you should be apologizing to the Lord. Not to worry about me. I have much trouble with that as you do. But the fact when he knew I was a pastor, and what I really should have said is I'm a Christian. Because being a pastor is nothing better than just being a Christian. It gets the opportunity to speak for God in a public way. We can do this. We can be salt in our workshop at home. We can be, because of the people you come in contact with. You can be in your office, in the place of employment. William Wilberforce was a committed Christian in England. He saw something that he thought was repulsive and repugnant, but all of society was involved in it. It was called the slave trade. The buying and selling of people, the bondage, the servitude of people. But William Wilberforce, a committed Christian, so inflamed the nation because of his speeches before Parliament. They hated him. But little by little, William Wilberforce turned the culture of England. Until they saw the slave trade as what it was, evil and repugnant. And they outlawed it. And it was then that America began to change. One man, one Christian man, one little grain of salt freed the slaves. That's incredible. The way to cure our world is to put salt in it. We can do more to slow down the spread of corruption by personally leading many men and women to Christ than by any other thing. It's amazing to me that after every great awakening or revival in the church, all of society has benefited. Dr. D. Martin Lloyd-Jones writes, he says, in the revival under Richard Baxter, not only were the people of God revived, but many of the unsaved were brought to repentance and redemption. The whole of that area was affected. Sin and vice were controlled dramatically. It happened the same way in the 17th and 18th century, and at the beginning of the past century, or the century past, in 1904, 1905, Christians just being Christians influenced society almost automatically. One of those, I read some time ago that at one point in the city of Denver, the revival was so pronounced and so effective, they laid off the police force. There wasn't any more crime. Because the salt had done its work. I'll close with this.